I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia is poised to become the first city to create a place to inject heroin and opioids under medical supervision. However, one major unknown is starting a big debate. What would the feds do? WHYY's Bobby Allen reports that one legal scholar says he found a loophole that can protect the so-called safe injection site.
There's this obscure rule in the federal 1970 Controlled Substances Act that basically says if an undercover cop buys drugs, the officer won't be prosecuted by the feds, even though buying the drugs is technically breaking the law. Alex Kreit is a drug policy expert at Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego. He wrote a textbook on the Controlled Substances Act.
There's a pretty strong argument that could be made that it would provide immunity to states and localities and their officials to set up something like a safe injection facility.
The idea behind a safe injection site is to have medical staff on hand who could prevent overdose deaths and also to help users connect with detox services. Kreit says Philadelphia officials can pass a local law backing such a facility and then ask a federal judge to block the feds from shutting it down, citing the immunity rule.
Pretty clear under the law that you do need to have some local or state, you know, law, ordinance, something on the books to say we are enforcing this provision of local law.
Opioid-fueled drug overdoses are believed to have killed more than 1,200 people in Philadelphia last year, and city leaders are moving closer to taking the controversial step of opening a safe injection site. If the city does, will there definitely be a federal crackdown?
I can't say that.
That's Pat Trainer. He's a spokesman for the Drug Enforcement Agency's Philly Field Office.
We are, as a federal law enforcement agency, we are tasked with going after the biggest and most complex drug trafficking organizations that are out there that are supplying the city.
If the feds do come after the site, some other legal experts say Kreit's loophole is not likely to work. Bob Reinstein is a law professor at Temple University.
I don't see any way around the federal government having the power to close this down and arrest everybody who's involved.
The best bet for the facility, Reinstein says, is for the city to convince the feds to take a hands-off approach for public health reasons. But he says convincing U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions of this will be a very tough political sell. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is now serving his final days in office. Come Tuesday, Democrat Phil Murphy will be sworn in. With a bigger-than-life personality, Christie was hailed for his commanding leadership after Superstorm Sandy, but Bridgegate took its toll on his political viability. He leaves office with historic low approval ratings for a Garden State governor. WHYY's Phil Gregory reports that political analysts say Christie made some big changes, many positive, but most residents will be glad to see him go.
Seton Hall political science professor Matthew Hale is giving Christie a grade of A for his first 4 years in office and an F for the last four. He says in his first term, Christie showed a remarkable ability to capture the imagination of people and was successful in getting bipartisan support in solving tough problems.
That went away when Chris Christie decided that he wanted to be president. He sort of abandoned New Jersey. And when he came back, he seemed to lose all interest in the bipartisanship, the compromise, and the willingness to get things done. It was his way or the highway.
Christie gets an overall grade of C+ from Ben Dworkin, the director of the Institute for Public Policy and Citizenship at Rowan University.
This is somebody who had once-in-a-generation political skills, and it all seemed squandered between Bridgegate and then an ill-fated presidential run and then the Trump endorsement.
Dworkin credits Christie for taking steps that help control property tax increases.
He absolutely changed the culture in Trenton. But we still have a pension crisis. We still have issues with urban schools. We still have tremendous transportation infrastructure problems. New Jersey Transit is a mess.
Hale says Christie did have significant accomplishments.
He's clearly the leader on combating the opioid epidemic. He clearly did some major things in bail reform. He did some fantastic things in reorganizing higher education. All of those things are going to be lasting and important things. But I think overall it's going to be about what could have been.
Christie says he'll be missed, but Dworkin says his record low voter approval rating in recent months shows the public doesn't agree.
They were more than ready to wave goodbye, and they have been for several months now. It was certainly that kind of approval rating, the governor will certainly shrug his shoulders and said he doesn't care. But the people who care are Republicans who have to run in his legacy.
What will Christie's legacy be? Hale says it depends on what happens in the future.
If the pension system gets worse, if the amount that we owe in that balloons and skyrockets even more beyond control, yeah, he's going to look a lot more favorable than we look at him today.
From the New Jersey desk, Phil Gregory, WHYY News.
The wait is almost over for Eagles fans as the Birds embark on their second season. But let's get this out of the way. They're doing it as the first number one seed underdog in division playoff history. To which Marcus Hayes, Daily News columnist, is likely to say, get over it. Joining me now is Marcus Hayes, and you say...
It's kind of what Philadelphia deserves, because the day after Carson Wentz was hurt in Game 13 in Los Angeles, there was this fatalistic sigh and said, well, it's not going to happen for us again. You know, it's been since 1960. It's 58 years and counting now. And the amazing thing about the fatalism is this is Philadelphia. Philadelphia will argue with anyone about its own greatness or its team's greatness. Except now, except in this moment. Am I in the wrong city? I mean, I could understand in this moment if things had conspired to bring about this malaise, things like losing a game. They won twice after they lost Carson Wentz, and Nick Foles brought the team back in the game in which they lost Carson Wentz. So they're 2-0 or 2.25-0. Since they lost their most important player, Carson Wentz, who, again, is an MVP candidate and a wonderful quarterback. But to say just because we lost Carson Wentz and replaced him with Nick Foles, who won us two games and threw four touchdown passes in one, kind of blows my mind. I mean, there was a time if Vegas made a Philly home playoff team an underdog, Philadelphia would have loaded up the planes, gone to Vegas, and burned it down.
Having said that, it is a reality that Carson Wentz was the main engine upon which the Eagles ended up 13-3. Nick Foles, more of a question mark, certainly.
Well, certainly, and that's what you are if you're the 33rd best quarterback in the league entering the season. There's a reason Mike Glennon had a starting spot at the beginning of the year and Nick Foles didn't. He's not good enough to start. That said, this assumption that Nick Foles is going to be a disaster is what's behind the underdog issue. And assuming that he's such a disaster that a very good team otherwise can't overcome him, to me is sort of preposterous.
So let's park the pessimism of many of the fans to the side. What's the mood in the locker room?
The mood in the locker room is absolute fury. Fury with Vegas. Fury with the analysts, other players, on the talking heads sitting around the desks saying, well, you know, no Carson Wentz, they can't win against the sixth-seed Atlanta team. And disappointment with most of us, most of the reporters that have, you know, sort of been with them on this ride and seen this defense be the number one defense against the run going into Week 16, where they played a meaningless game with half of their starters sitting. It's the number one rushing offense overall, and they're still a 2.5-3-point dog. All of these things conspire to make Nick Foles feel put upon, Doug Peterson, coach of the year candidate, feel put upon, and the other 51 guys on the roster just feel incredibly disrespected because they believe that the world sees them as Carson Wentz and company, not a really, really good team, which I believe is unfair, and they rightfully believe is unfair.
Well, that fury then serves as fuel, though Atlanta acquitted themselves quite nicely against Los Angeles last week.
Mm-hmm. Atlanta's not a bad team, but Atlanta has no real case. I understand with the bookies, they set the line according to where they think the money's going to be, but I can't see them being a favorite against this team, even though it's Nick Foles. They did very few things really well consistently. They're the best team, for example, they're the best third down team in the NFL. But for a 4-week period, they were the worst third down team in the NFL. They were very, very good before, and they're very, very good after. And maybe they're going to be very, very good on Saturday, but they're not flawless. They have their issues. So a lot of things stack up in the Eagles' favor, except general sentiment.
Should the Eagles not move on to take on the winner of Minnesota, New Orleans? Would that entail a real rethinking about this team going forward into the next season, or is it obviously because they've lost Carson Wentz?
I think the second option is how things will be regarded. You know, this isn't a perfect team, and they have some issues going into the offseason. Who's going to be their left tackle next year? Is it going to be Jason Peters, who before he got hurt was probably the best player on the team? But he blew out his knee and he's 36 years old. Is it going to be him or Halavelapuutivaatai to protect Carson Wentz, assuming Carson Wentz comes back in a timely fashion? We don't know who's going to be the starting quarterback on opening day next year, but they have an issue at left tackle. They have their best linebacker this year is Nigel Bradham. The reason they're number one against the run isn't necessarily because of Nigel Bradham. They have two great defensive tackles, Fletcher Cox and Tim Jernigan, but Nigel Bradham made the plays behind them. Is Nigel Bradham going to be back? You know, so there are lots of issues beyond Carson Wentz that they have to resolve before next year begins. But getting a healthy Carson Wentz back in the pocket it's not a cure-all, but it's a big step forward.
Thanks, Marcus.
Thanks, Dave.
Philadelphia Daily News columnist Marcus Hayes on Newsworks Tonight. Martin Luther King's legacy goes beyond the civil rights movement and fighting racial injustice to include the environmental justice movement, the idea that everyone has the same right to be protected from pollution. But the Trump administration is threatening that legacy. Cuts proposed to the Environmental Protection Agency eliminate the Office of Environmental Justice. Catalina Jaramillo of WHYY's Plan Philly reports on how this will affect Philadelphia.
It was a stormy night in Memphis, Tennessee, and Martin Luther King Jr. was not feeling very well. He had a slight fever, a sore throat, and he was exhausted after the trip that brought him to the city that would see him die. But he got up from his bed and joined hundreds of striking garbage workers. It was April 3, 1968, the night before his assassination.
The issue is injustice. The issue is the refusal of Memphis to be fair and honest in its dealings with its public servants who happen to be sanitation workers.
The issue was also injustice because the sanitation workers happen to be black. And although the term environmental justice emerged decades after King delivered this, his last speech, his work is considered the bedrock of the environmental justice movement, a movement that institutionalized the right to be equally protected from pollution. Robert Bullard is a professor at Texas Southern University. If King was considered the founding father of environmental justice, Bullard would be his firstborn son.
Dr. King was a forerunner in this area and set the tone and the stage for understanding the relationship between work and pay and civil rights and equal treatment. You know, the civil rights movement gave birth to the environmental justice movement. It's an extension of.
But King's legacy could be significantly affected this year. Mustafa Ali co-founded and led the Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Environmental Justice for 24 years. Cuts in President Trump's first budget reduced the office, forcing Ali to resign last spring.
Communities. I knew more folks were going to get sick, and eventually more folks are going to die based upon the choices that they were moving forward on.
Although the Environmental Justice Office still exists, its budget is mostly cut, and it's no longer a national program. This year, President Trump wants to completely eliminate funding for it. The EPA says the changes will allow the agency to achieve its goal better, arguing they're just moving the office and that environmental justice will still be supported. But Ali says downgrading it sends the message that environmental justice is no longer a priority.
We're going backwards 25 years to a time when communities of color, low-income communities, and indigenous populations didn't have access to information, to decision-making, all those various things.
The Overbrook Environmental Education Center, located in West Philadelphia, used to be a contaminated site. But 15 years ago, its neighbors turned it into a community center focused on environmental education.
We have cherry, peach, plum.
Jerome Shabazz is the head and heart of the organization. The site has an orchard, a greenhouse, and murals. And they have workshops to teach the neighbors how to grow food and how to protect themselves from toxins like lead.
We were given a book.
Before coming to the Overbrook Center, Erica Tanell didn't know her family or her neighbors could be exposed to lead just by spending time in their homes.
I didn't know that soil has certain things in it. I just thought dirt was dirt, see? But once I came here and they gave us the knowledge and the tools, and then I volunteered to have people come, and they were testing this and testing that, it was fascinating.
The Overbrook Center can train neighbors like Tanell thanks to an environmental justice grant they got from the EPA.
There was a big gap between truth and fiction. And so as a result of our EPA grant, we created this campaign called Did You Know?
Did you know we have a plan to change the world with our itty-bitty hands?
Did you know lead is poisonous? It can be found in the air, the soil, and the water, even in the paint inside your home.
Bunch of kids getting ready for the taking.
This kind of information gave Tanell power.
Finding this out can save your life. It can make you live longer. When you have knowledge, you know better, you do better.
Look into his neighborhood from the Overbrook Center greenhouse, located on a small hill. Shabazz dreams of the projects to come. He sees himself as carrying King's legacy by lifting vulnerable communities with knowledge.
He gave them voice, and it's important for all of us to keep the legacy of that work alive.
Shabazz says Trump's plan to eliminate the environmental justice program is horrible for Philadelphia because it will leave people without protection. Catalina Jaramillo, WHYY News.
Now, 3 weeks out from President Donald Trump signing the new tax bill into law, let's examine public perceptions with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, have attitudes changed in the time since the bill's been signed?
Not really. One of the reasons we went back into the field in January, just a few days ago, is to see if that was the case, because our polling and all the other polling had occurred while the bill was still being debated, and Trump didn't sign it into law until the 22nd of December. So we said, all right, now that it's law, a lot of talk about how great it is by Republicans and the president. Let's see what's happened. And, drum roll, nothing changed. About 55% of Americans disapprove of the law now, and that's roughly the same as was the case when we asked about it in early December. So no movement yet in terms of the average American's perceptions of the bill.
Perhaps for many, the rubber will meet the road April 15th.
That's right. I think that the proponents of the bill argue that once people see more money in their paychecks, they will be more positive about it, and maybe that's the case. I should say something else, though, Dave. One of the reasons that Congress was so happy about passing this bill is they had done something. You know, one of the criticisms last year was that Congress couldn't get anything done, so that wouldn't really depend on paychecks. Having accomplished something, you might have expected Congress job approval to go up, and it didn't. It is now 20% overall, but that's about the average for last year. So we're not seeing any indication yet that passing this bill has improved the image of Congress across the board.
Let's stay on Congress and more specifically, political party identification.
Yeah, this is fascinating. What happened last year, it was an election year, was that fewer Americans identified as independents, more identified as Republicans and Democrats. And that's typical in a presidential year because everybody's focused on politics and the parties. And usually in the year after, we would see a decrease in the percent of people who identify with political parties. And that's the case. We now have 42% of Americans who are independents. When we first asked the question, that's up from last year, and declining numbers in recent years more generally who identify either as Republicans or Democrats. So we've got a kind of push to the neither of the party sentiment on the part of the average American.
Let's look through the measure of conservative, progressive, liberal.
I remember Alec Gallup, one of the founders of our company, the son of the founder, used to tell me, oh, the L word, liberal word, is anathema to a lot of Americans. But, and this is the point, we're seeing an increasing number of Americans who actually choose that label. We ask a simple question, are you conservative, moderate, or liberal? And conservative still wins out. It's about tied with moderate. Liberal's a little below that, but the percent liberal has been going up.
Now, these are self-disclosed, I presume.
That's right. We simply say which of these labels best describes you. And the change has been most dramatic among Democrats. There was a point in time when the majority of Democrats, or at least the plurality of Democrats, identified as conservative Democrats. But now that's changed. Over the last 7 or 8 years, we've seen an increase in liberal Democrats, so now that's by far the number one label among Democrats. 50% of all Democrats in this country, Dave, say they're liberal. And then the rest of them say they are either moderate or conservative. So that's a change. More polarization, in other words.
Frank, in the context of hashtag MeToo, let's take up attitudes around women.
We last guessed that in 2008, so we re-ask it again this year, and the dissatisfaction with the situation of women is up. It's not huge. 37% of Americans say they're very or somewhat dissatisfied with the position of women, but that's the highest that we've seen in our years of measuring it.
How do those numbers break down first by gender and then by political stripe?
Well, it's fairly predictable. Women are more likely to say they are dissatisfied than men. That was the case in 08, 10 years ago, when we last asked it. It's the case now. Democrats are more likely to say they are dissatisfied than Republicans. But what our analysts found fascinating when we stared at these data is that the jump over the last 10 years in dissatisfaction with the position of women was almost entirely due to Democrats. Republicans, who aren't that dissatisfied now, weren't that dissatisfied in 08. Their position hasn't really moved.
Does that include Republican women who don't report much change from 10 years ago?
That's right. We broke it out. Republican men, Republican women, no change.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Vinyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. Assistant news director, Katie Colinari. John Musoni is assistant vice president for news operations. Our engineers this week, Bob Alls, Charlie Kyer, and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.